The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2023, Charting the Course, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join. or by making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, please visit libraplanet.org/conference.
You can start whenever you want.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. Although I can't really see you, but hopefully you can see me. And I'm super excited today to give this talk on the nexus of free software and environmental sciences. And I have been a student for most of my life and until my graduation several years. Now I'm a scientist at Scripps, University of California. Throughout past several years, I have been learning about the open source initiative and free software. I found some of the ideas naturally overlap with the open and sharing spirit that we cherish in an academic setting. But frankly, I found it odd that this conversation does not happen more often within my field. So this is my first presentation at Libra Planet, trying to bring awareness to this connection and hopefully to have more conversations with you on how education can be made better with free software. So a little bit about myself. I consider myself an educator by working with students in an academic institution. I direct the summer internship program at our center, where every year we bring in a number of undergraduates and we teach them how to launch weather balloons and build predictive algorithms for weather forecasting. I'm a geographer by training, and thanks to my advisor, I had training also on computer science. And I got to work a lot on scientific computing and machine learning. So this figure here shows that shows the daily precipitation forecast generated by machine learning. This is what I do for research and using machine learning for extreme event forecasting. And that, you know, atmospheric science, that is pretty much going to be the type of environmental science I'm going to mainly talk about today. So that gives you some kind of idea of what type of environmental science we're going to talk about. And personally, I developed an interest in free software when I was a student. And since then, I've been trying to publish my research code as much as I can and also find projects I can contribute. So last year, I proudly worked on two projects. One is actually for the BangoJS smartwatch. I'm not sure if you heard about that. It is an open source system based on JavaScript. And I developed an app to remind you to stand up and move for every set of amount of time. And another project was for the Nextcloud ecosystem. I was trying to improve the visualization of a time tracker app, if you are aware. So I would like to start my presentation today with a quote from Professor Seymour Burt at MIT, where he said, "The role of teacher is to create the conditions for invention rather than provide ready-made knowledge." Well, back in the 1960s, Professor Papert was perhaps the first to argue that you should use computers as instruments for learning and for enhancing creativity, innovation, and computational thinking. He advocated we need to have a computer, personal computer, for every child, like a notebook and a pencil. So that was almost unheard of back then. But after 60 years of development, we now have much easier access to these devices in the US, at least. However, having recently completed my education, I sometimes look back and still wonder, are we creating the conditions for invention at universities? Technologies have significantly changed our lives, but have also become much more complex. So are we enabling teaching technology to promote creativity and innovation? Therefore, in this talk, I hope to examine these similarities and the missing links between free software and sciences. When I was a student at Penn State University, in our statistics courses, the instructor would teach us something called Minitab. It is a commercial software for statistical analysis. The teaching approach typically goes like this. First, there are several lectures on how you would compute, let's say, confidence interval or carry out statistical tests. But then we will have hands-on labs on how to do it. Well, the so-called hands-on labs to me back then were less about doing it myself, but more about finding out which button to click and in which order. So it was convenient, and I sort of felt like I can do it in a way, but not entirely. That bit of insecurity would accumulate whenever I used Minitab, and finally I chose to stay away from it and did my final project in R, so that just I'm 100% sure what I'm calculating and how I arrive at the final number. In my case, the switch was an easy decision because I searched around and realized that learning this software won't help me get on a better job, and my senior students were not using it for their own research. So the real question here was why the university was still teaching it. Well, I'd like to explore a little bit more on the ideas of feeling in control and having convenience. I would argue that using commercial software like Minitab might make it easier for me to finish my assignment. And perhaps if I don't feel overwhelmed, I'll give the instructor a higher score. However, I believe in the saying that those who do the most work do the most learning. In a learning environment, I don't think convenience should be the go-to factor when deciding what technology and software to teach in classes. Unfortunately, on this spectrum, from having control and the convenience, universities are more oftentimes inclining to the right-hand side. This tendency would give students the wrong idea that we don't need control. And in the long run, I think that value conveyed will be problematic. So let's take a look at the concept of open science. I was amazed by the level of overlap when open science and free software, when I stumbled upon their definitions. Here, open science can mean really many different things, including open data, open content, open knowledge. The word open means anyone can freely access, use, modify, and share for any purpose. And if we take a look at the free in free software, it means that users have the freedom to run, copy, distribute, study, change, and improve the software. I see a lot of shared values between open science and the free software, and that makes me excited when I use software for my teaching and research, knowing that the tools I use are developed by a group of like-minded people that embrace user freedom and openness. So to put things in perspective, there was a study on open science, and it talks about this idea from four aspects, and we're going to look at each one of them individually. So the first one is a philanthropic perspective. Doing research requires content-related elements whose access has been predominantly restricted. Current trends foster the democratization of science and research in the sense of distributing scientific contents, tools, and infrastructures freely. For example, the deep learning course from MIT and the geography course from Penn State. I have taken both these courses and I'm amazed by how recent the materials are. And they're not about some outdated topics, but they follow the latest trend and latest trend in the field, and I find this very interesting. However, another observation I also had was that there is an imbalance in scientific fields for the increase of these free materials online. Although I haven't done surveys on this, but I would say the most increase is probably in data science and machine learning, which is typically the beneficiary of free and open source software. Other fields might not see as fast of a development of free content online. Even if I look at geography, we have fairly good support from the community, and we're seeing more tutorials on how to use tools. And additionally, open access journals are also on the rise that provides users with the non-restricted right to use the full text of articles. As most traditional journals generate revenues based on subscriptions, the majority of open access journals are funded by the authors through publication fees. However, in my mind, this is a much more sluggish progress compared to the other one, and I would love to hope to see that it pick up its speed. So the second aspect is the reflationary perspective, and we have witnessed a trend to make scientific results freely available even during pre-publication, and more often you see news reports linking to papers in the manuscript archive. And just to name a few, we have archives for earth science, computer science, health science, and biology. So these archived manuscripts are not peer-reviewed. They're just uploaded by the authors for sharing purposes. So knowledge is shared in an early stage of research process. A few reasons why researchers would want to do that. One is actually in the self-interest of their own. Studies have found out papers with pre-publication prints get cited more often and receive more attention. And since acknowledgement is a great incentive and has great power in academia, more people accept this idea. And at large, early sharing promotes new ideas and collaborations. And in fact, many recent innovations in machine learning first came out on archive and received a great deal of attention, which in turn had impact to influence future research directions. And this perspective just reminds me that for open source projects, developers are usually open about what they would like to develop from day one, and perhaps even go the extra mile to document their development progress on platforms like GitHub and Discord. So the next aspect is what they termed constructivistic perspective. In this perspective, the authors are talking about possibilities for new forms of collaboration and new forms of knowledge creation. The most notable example, outsourcing and research. So I have a few examples for you today. The first example of crowdsourcing is the Missing Map campaign, which aims to map the most vulnerable so that international and local non-governmental organizations use the maps and data to better respond to crisis. The key to this process is community building. People who digitized all the satellite images are volunteers, and this presents a huge financial benefit to local and humanitarian organizations. So more related to myself, here's another example from my past group that relied on crowdsourced effort for cross dataset validation. Radioactive releases into the atmosphere have spatial temporal dimensions as the radiation disperses over space and decays over time. After the Fukushima event in 2011, the SafeCast project, there's a small picture on the photo on the upper right, that is the device. So people began to assemble off-the-shelf parts produce handheld scientifically graded Geiger counts, distribute these devices to cities, and crowdsource the radiation measurements to a collective map. Radiation measurements using SafeCast are continually uploaded with exponential growth in entries to 14 million in Japan and 28 million globally as of May 2015. So the first figure on the left shows a spatial distribution of these entries. So my colleague back then, Dr. Caroline Hawquist, then used the citizen volunteered data set to compare it with the government generated radiation data and assess its quality. So these two data sets have distinct features. SafeCast provided the ground data in urban area and along roads, as you can see in the middle panel, while the government generated data was collected in large swath patterns from planes for specific dates. So her work showed that actionable scientific data for disasters and emergencies can be inferred from non-traditional and not vetted data generated through citizen science projects. Another example is more related to myself and also related to extreme heat events in urban areas. Heat waves have a highly localized impact, especially when considering the location of vulnerable groups, but operational weather models typically do not have sufficient spatial resolution to accurately predict regions at risk. Model downscaling is therefore a technique to increase model resolution so that it provides more details when zoomed in. But it typically requires some high resolution information to begin with. To address this problem, we used a crowdsourced data set from Weather Underground. They set up a platform for sharing weather data collected at cost weather stations. And can purchase a station and set it up, then the data will be uploaded so that one can access it back then. The figure on the left shows the global distribution of over 250,000 stations worldwide, and it provides block level coverage in urban areas. As you can see on the right in the panel C, this one, the regional temperature does not show any variation on Manhattan because of the coarse resolution, but we can integrate the block level observations with the model forecast to get a detailed view of the temperature. The red regions are ones that should receive extra attention as they are more likely impacted by an incoming heat. So finally, the fourth aspect is the exploitative perspective. Sometimes research can be criticized as neglecting application and sharing and promotion of scientific knowledge enable researchers to close this toward application-oriented knowledge faster. When I read about this, I naturally thought the idea that software should be controlled by the users so that user-oriented features can be developed. I would use my current work at Scripps as an example. We are conducting a series of projects under the forecast informed reservoir operations. So the goal here is to translate the latest findings in information and advice on managing reservoirs in the U.S. There is a screenshot showing a real-time estimate on how much water and snowpack we currently have. You know, and the bottom figure shows the construction of a particular dam. If we have no idea about an incoming storm or how strong it's going to be, we have to keep the water level low in the reservoir to account for extremes. But if we have an accurate estimation of the amount of precipitation through forecast, and we know how much water we're going to receive, we can fill our reservoir to a higher level without creating overflow or leading to flooding. We found that over 2 billion gallons per year of storm water could potentially be added to groundwater recharge in Orange County, California. So hopefully with these examples and perspectives, I have convinced you that free software and open science share a lot of common features and values. And I truly believe that the free software idea in general can help us do better science. So next, let's talk more about it. And I'd like to examine how free software can help by looking at this question. Why is openness important in science? The first big part lies in reproducibility. Reproducibility is essential, but at the same time tricky because it is affected by a number of factors that are intrinsically difficult to document. Those include technical factors, human factors, and study design and statistics. The last quadrant is more related to publication, so we're going to mainly talk about the first three quadrants. However, even with the first three quadrants, they are still qualitative measures for guiding reproducibility. Fortunately, with computer programs taking up a larger portion of our analysis, the idea is that if we publish our data together with the analysis code, reviewers can comment on details of the experiments and analysis. In other words, the level of reproducibility can be measured using this spectrum that is based on how well the code is shared and documented. If the code is easy to set up and run, people can validate the results and make sure and make further modifications to the program for their own research. I think this spectrum has motivated a large group of researchers to publish and package their research code so that more people can easily use them in their own research. And just to name a few, in my own workflow, I was able to rely on a number of free and open source software to make sure my experiments and analysis are well documented. Git and are among the most popular tools to document these processes. GeoCat is actually a community-driven project that aims at creating scalable data analysis and visualization tools for Earth system science data. And it really makes the scientific computing and scalable computing easy, accessible for researchers. We often find ourselves doing similar analysis and visualizations with different data sets. So this Python module was created for this purpose. On a lower level, it depends on a number of well-known Python modules, including Dask for scalable computing, Xarray, NumPy for scientific computing. I'm always amazed by how much free and open source software has developed and how well they work together within my research workflow. On the right, a typical cycle for data science. The community has preferred free and open source software almost in each stage, thanks to the good documentation and the fact that these tools are updated for the use. And also, I want to mention that on the status quo, I'm very glad to see that the impact of free and open source software not simply stop at being useful tools, but the importance is at being acknowledged more and more on platforms like Paper with Code. This is a feedback loop that would encourage people to pick up free and open source software when they want to try the latest products. So on our second note, why openness is important, the research topics we have today are increasingly complex yet specialized. So let me explain that to people. You might have already heard the atmospheric river lately due to the excessive amount of rain we received this winter. So if you don't know, an atmospheric river refers to the narrow corridor of concentrated moisture in the atmosphere. They bring a large amount of water from the tropics and make landfall in the western US, thanks to the preferred mountainous topography as shown in the left figure diagram. And on a satellite image on the right, this is what an atmospheric river would look like. You might think this is a topic only concerning meteorologists, but in the next slide, I'm going to show you how widely connected this topic can be. First, it is an engineering problem. A better understanding of the phenomenon must come from good quality observations. We usually deploy drop sounds in the storms to collect environmental variables like measurements like pressure, wind speed, and the temperature. When and where to develop those drop sounds become critical during observation stage. There are also a number of ground-based stations that monitor variables like surface runoff, which is important to warn against flooding. These stations typically need regular maintenance. Then there is the modeling team, which is usually composed of meteorologists and computer scientists. They work together to ensure the correct physics is properly implemented and the algorithm is sufficiently fast, and so that we can generate forecasts in time. After the forecasts have been generated, the post-processing team would then carry out statistical corrections to remove known bias in the model and generate the final version of forecast to be used by downstream applications. Well, downstream users would include policymakers, hydrologists, and operators. In this workflow, the problem is highly complex, but knowledge is highly specialized. In other words, I don't think there is any commercial software that is able to cover all these grounds. Therefore, free and open source software is really the only solution here. At our center, I have seen commercial software slowly fading out from the workflow. So up until now, we have covered one, the similarity between open source and free software, and two, how free software is already making impact in open science. The question is, how can we maintain this momentum and make integration more sustainable? So let's talk a little bit more about the teaching free software for environmental science. So first question, is it possible to only use environmental research? Well, in my personal experience, I think the answer is positive. Data analysis is critical, and I think both R and Python have reached the level of completeness that they can cover almost any analysis I would like to carry out. Even if you are not a computer science background student or researcher, you'll always be able to find existing packages to do what you want to do. And with access to the source code, you can learn how to do it yourself. More specifically for geospatial analysis, GIS fulfills most of my analysis. And even if I can't find the exact tool, I always fall back to Python and fall back to rely on the geospatial modules. OpenStreetMap and Mapbox provide very good spatial data sets and APIs for visualization. And finally, research also includes activities like literature review and scientific writing. More tools exist for this purpose. Just to name a few, I use LaTeX for writing and publishing. And the VS Codeium is the community build of VS Code. And Zotero Uplink work for literature review. One particular argument against free and open source software that I sometimes hear is that free and open source software is not reliable and not well documented. Their usage can be cumbersome and teaching how to use them becomes even more difficult. In this case, educators easily turn to commercial solutions which seem to work just fine. However, in my perspective, I would argue that free and open software is as documented and reliable as the alternative. Of course, it is actually the educator's responsibility to choose the proper open source software to teach, because considering different projects can be at different stage of development. If students are let alone in the wild, they can easily get lost. More importantly, I don't think education is complete if students do not know how to implement the analysis. For example, we sometimes hear that educators say we teach the math first and teach them how to use the toolbox. But let's, for example, even if we are taught that this will be the equation for linear regression on the left, to go from the math on the right to actually getting the regressed line on the right, and then use this regressed line for your own research, there are many other steps involved. But very often when just using toolbox, these steps are hidden. For example, data parameter estimation and significance testing. I remember my advisor used to say that the devil is in the details, and he encouraged me not to be afraid to face the devil and go into the details. Some other related arguments can be, we don't need to read source code for learning purposes, and reading and teaching the source code is too time consuming. My response to this line of opinion is that teaching free and open software to students actually imposes a higher requirement on the educators than students. Students, when just starting out, they don't have a preference on which one to use. They simply follow the guidance from the teacher. Both are new to them. But teaching free and open source software actually requires a change in how syllabus is structured and courses are taught. For example, courses in computer science are typically optional for students in environmental science, but I would argue that a minimum number of programming courses should be required so that later on, when they're exposed to the idea of open source, they know what to do with the source code. And more importantly, they know what they can do with the source code. And students typically need guidance when reading source code. And just to give a very simple example, here using the bubble sort algorithm, I copied this code from online. And in a simple algorithm like the bubble sort, there is a large portion of code that is less related to the key idea, but more related to the housekeeping and other perspectives. If I highlight the two lines that are really relevant, perhaps this would be easier for you to read them and to understand the core idea of shifting the neighbor two elements. And then you can slowly expand to the rest of the code to understand why you use them. This guidance is generally missing, and no wonder students are afraid of reading source code, and then they just shut it off entirely. So to sum up, I think we can focus our attention on trying to teach free software on the following aspects. First, choose the right software. Second is provide context and why having access to the source code is important and what we can do with the source code. Then we start with examples and hands-on tutorials, really showing the students of how to get from A to B. Yeah, guide them to investigate implementation. This is paramountly important in my the time you care about the specific features of functionality, you need the ability. Educators should chat skill for students to review code. And collaborative learning, finally, this is a learning context, so we always try to make it fun. Before I wrap up my talk, I'd like to share my thoughts on recent discussion of generative AI, specifically ChatGPT. I think I won't be able to get away without talking about these topics here. So people should, you might already be aware of what ChatGPT is at this point. It has showed jaw-dropping abilities to do tasks that are previously thought to be hard for computers. Students are using it to write plausible college essays, and GPT has been shown to pass numerous high-level exams. So the question is, should we teach ChatGPT in our classroom? Well, I think it is appropriate to ask ChatGPT that question, right? So I'm actually surprised by the answer. So what, according to ChatGPT, is saying that it's not necessary to teach itself as a subject in college. Instead, it may be more valuable to teach the underlying concepts and technologies that make language models possible. And teaching this foundational concept, students can gain a deeper understanding. And additionally, it goes on to talk about the ethical considerations and the potential societal impact of this tool. So, however, I think, meanwhile, I am slightly answered, I still think it is currently still hard to do so. ChatGPT is currently not an open source software, and that is bugging the scientific community a lot lately. Researchers have been saying that if we don't have access, how are we supposed to study the tools and build trust into the tool? So I have been seeking the open source alternatives like ChatRWK. If you're curious, I highly recommend you to check that out. Another issue actually in the computer. Training this must currently take a large amount of computation that is only available from private companies. I don't think currently institutes have that level of GPU resources to train these large language models. So that adds another level of complexity in democratization of this technology. Okay, and here's my last slide. I'd like to share my final thoughts with you to wrap up this talk. We start taking up our direction in science and education. How we treat them also becomes important. I think free software is not just about technology, it's also about values. And similarly, education is not just about occupation, it is also about critical thinking and being creative. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions and yeah.
All right, thank you so much for that talk. If anybody in the room has any questions, feel free to step up to the mic and ask your questions. But before, you know, if anybody, there were some questions on IRC. So this is a kind of a long question/comment, but Afdal says, an interesting story from my own field of study. There's been a phenomenon that probably wasn't an issue in the past of unpublished computing tools and code. Someone develops a statistical analysis package that produces good-looking figures, and then everybody adopts the method because it's easy to use. However, it can become so easy and alluring that they forget to question whether the underlying statistical assumptions about their model are justified. And then he asks, I wonder if this happened less often when everybody had to write their own model or simulation instead of grabbing someone else's published code. So just wondering what you were thinking about this.
That definitely is true. Because on the other hand, you know, the development is a highly complex process. Even for as scientists, I know that sometimes we write code that we never going to show them to others. That platform comes in a very good niche for this. That when you publish your articles, you also publish your code so that other people can actually take it. And first, I'll do is really a test whether that does what it will do, and then I will understand if it really works in there. And then finally, I'll make the decision whether I use it in my workflow. So another point to that is more about the more attention a project is receiving, the more often this project is being vetted by the community. And through that process, we're built trust to a certain public code. In general, I think there's a spectrum that we're dealing with in open source code, where well documented, well tested, and all other ways their time code. And for those, yes, do. And there is a spectrum.
So sometimes we're losing your outbound video stream. So I don't know if turning off your camera would help, but maybe we can try that.
You mean turning off the video of myself?
Yes, the video of yourself.
Okay.
And we have another question in the room too.
Hello, my name is Bob, and I really enjoyed your talk. Earlier, you were talking about open journals and such, because it seems a tragedy that we have a lot of community-funded research, and then it's published in restrictive journals, making it very difficult. How can we make journal articles more freely available to people?
So, thank you. That is a tough question. I think that, so right now there are typically several options for you to make your research more accessible. And there is, let's say, more traditionally, there is the, let's say, subscription-based journal, where you can actually, once the manuscript is accepted, you could, as I said, you could post the pre-publication or, you know, the preprints onto other platforms like ResearchGate, and then those links will be referenced. So even people without a subscription, they can still find a preprint version of that. However, I am not too much of a fan of that, because you are still using, you know, the funding, the money to support a closed subscription model. And what I really feel what we need is more open access journals in the field. And I think that is happening, and there are more open access. There are more journals based on open access. So that typically means a different funding source for the journals, and which I'm talking about. Usually, authors are paying for them for the publication fee. And so, in general, I think there are different ways to make your products available by publishing, by self-hosting them. And I think we should, earlier on in our research, when we're in our, think about those questions. Where this science is take us, and where can we publish it? Can we find it enough access, you know, to publish this? So I think those kind of conversations should also happen at a much earlier stage during the research program.
Another question I have is about the very last there you were talking about, ChatGPT. And with the ChatGPT, I mean, it seems to me like it's, you know, it's like a very clever intern who's very enthusiastic and very excited that sometimes lies to you. And if this was, it's very good at absorbing things and regurgitating things. So if it was money, we would call it money laundering, but it's all about intellectual things. And so is this like a laundry service for intellectual, where we lose the providence of it? If it was a scientific paper, we would look at the citations and we would be able to see how we arrived at this place. But with ChatGPT, we just suddenly have an arrival and we have no idea how it got there. What should we do about that?
That's an interesting comment. And I have no affiliation with the company, and so I can't really comment on how similar it is to a Mondri service. But you know, at a higher level, this is definitely not something new, because if you think about for Copilot from Microsoft, it's a similar thing, right? We training your model on the public data on open source code, and then you commercialize the service, and which I think is not a good practice. But what we're seeing here is similar. ChatGPT is trained on a large set of set or documents on the internet, and then it provides this mysterious response to the questions we ask. So and that is what you ask is exactly the pain point where, I mean, as a scientist, as a researcher, that we're experiencing. We don't have the source code to the model, and I think the companies are being sneaky about this, and they won't publish it for whatever reasons. And second is getting more important is actually, even if we have open source, we may not be able to set a model for research because of the computational resources that it take. And as I said previously, if you think about, let's say, Comet or Shenyang of the supercomputers from the institute, they're not heavy, very strong on GPU. So we can't even train that, even if we have this. So that is going to be a problem that we need to address in the near future.
Okay, there's some great questions in IRC, but I think that's all the time that we have for today. So another round of applause for Wei Ming. And with that, I think it's
time for our break.
Thank you.